Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon, for the opportunity for me to come share with you. I'm excited about what the Lord has given me to share with you. And I'd like to take a moment to just open in prayer, so if you'd pray with me. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for those who have worked so hard to make this weekend possible. Thank you for being our God, for revealing yourself to us, for doing all that is required because we can't do it ourselves. We ask that you would be present in this room during this next hour, that you would enlighten our hearts, open our minds and our ears to be able to hear the words that you are bringing to us. We ask that you would multiply this ministry that you have given us and that you would use it to reach all the people that you have designed it for. And we ask this in the name of your Son, our Savior. Amen. My name is Betty Hanks. I am the founder and president of Realizing True Hope Ministries. And we work with women who have a history of abuse. And part of that working with those women includes working with the churches where they attend to help the people that love them learn how to love them well, to support them so that they can find a path to healing that God has already laid out for them. This quote from the movie The Miracle Worker, the 1962 edition, really struck me is when Anne Sullivan says, "Can nothing be done to disinter this human soul? The whole neighborhood would rush to save this woman if she were buried alive. By the caving in of a pit and labor with zeal until she were dug out. Now, if there were one who had as much patience as this, he might awaken to her a consciousness of her immortal nature. The chance is small indeed, but with a smaller chance, they would have dug desperately for her in the life of the pit. And is the life of the soul of less import than that of the body?" And the same is true if you think about wounded women. We will fight to the death to free her from physical peril. But when she comes and says, "I'm hurting and I'm broken from things that happened to me in my past," the tendency is to tell her, "Don't talk about that. That's too painful. I don't know what to do with that." So we kind of shut that down. And we leave her languishing in her brokenness. And that's not what the Lord has planned for her. So in order to talk about this in a way that will be beneficial to you guys going back into your communities, I want to talk about the truth of God, and the truth of the reality of a wounded woman. First, we know that truth is not subjective. We're talking about capital T truth, the truth of God. It's not subjective. It doesn't change. It is not a consensual cultural construct. It's not an invalid, outdated, irrelevant concept that culture would tell you truth is today. Truth is the self-expression of God. It is the reality God created and defined and over which he rules. Truth is not dictated by our circumstances. However, our ability to discern and interpret the truth appropriately is defined by our experiences. When a woman experiences abuse, her perception of the truth is, in fact, redefined. It is this truth to which we must strive to introduce a woman impacted by the trauma of abuse. So how does the experience of trauma impact the truth in a woman's world? The experiences of a woman who has endured trauma dictate a different truth for her life. While her experiences do not change the truth of God, they do establish and maintain dominance over her soul. In order to survive, the body sidelines her true self to a painful, dusty world of isolation. Let me clarify, when I say true self, I'm not talking about this new age, everything's about me, I define the world. When I say true self, I'm talking about the woman that God created me to be. That is my true self. She still exists despite sin in the world, and the Lord is in the process of revealing her to me as I walk with him and he makes me more like Christ. Have you ever returned to an old storage place, a closet, a shed, a storage unit, something where you have locked away things that you don't look at all the time? And in that place, old memories and mementos are housed, and you haven't seen them in years. When you open the box marked childhood, you find things that will either make you smile out of a happy memory or cringe out of something that you really didn't want to remember. The opening of that box brings memories and emotions that you haven't thought about in a really long time, maybe even decades. In much the same way, her true self, the woman God created her to be, is living, though not thriving as she was designed to, in a dark, musty storage shed deep inside of her. And she will remain there until the Holy Spirit leads her back to that place where she can begin to rediscover the past and its impact on her true self. She must bring the truth of who she is, who God is, what is real in this world, into conflict with everything that she believes about herself because of the abuses she's suffered. Does God live in this place of conflict? Is he present in the dark and musty storage container where she's not even glimpsed or dreamed of entering for so many years? What if she's chosen a life of sin to cover up her pain? What if she's turned her back on the Lord? If she's chosen drugs, alcohol, sex, people, her job, any one of hundreds of things that she could choose to abuse rather than look at the pain of her past? Is her deliberate choice a sin over obedience to God for God's glory? Perhaps God allowed her sin choices for a period to be a bridge where he would meet her, to take her back into those painful places, where he can reveal himself to her, where he can show her that all those things you believed about yourself because of what happened to you are not true, and I'm going to reveal that to you here. Perhaps the emotional earthquakes that she experiences, which create for her only distorted options for dealing with reality, are the tools the Lord will use to draw her to a place where he will meet with her to begin to bring her healing. The process of healing and redefining herself in the truth of God's reality for her life is not a horizontal process. It has unexpected turns that will throw her for a loop, and they'll scare you too if you walk with her. It has very high highs and immensely low lows. And 9 times out of 10, you don't see them coming. It seems to start over again from the very beginning, time and time again. Yet God, in his perfect providence for her life, has designed exactly the path that she should travel. The perfect plan for her healing. It's almost never what we would desire or expect or imagine in our human thinking. And it requires a profound ability to lean on God's understanding, which is something that we as humans fall short of just because of humanity. Come, if you pile the abuse aspect on top of it, she can't even begin to think about leaning on God's understanding. That's where she needs you. That's why she needs a mentor who is mature in his or her faith, who is willing to submit to God's will rather than our own will to walk with her. Rather than insisting that she heal in a specific time frame or under a specific therapeutic method or with certain measurable criteria, we need to be able to trust that God is in the midst of her healing, walking her on the path that he has designed for her. Even when she bucks it, even when she turns her back on it and comes back time and time again, that is the path that the Lord has laid out for her. During this time, she will question the truth, both the truth that she understands and the greater truth that exists because God is. Her GPS will reroute her over and over and over again, and it will frustrate you to no end. It's all she knows. Be patient while she works it out. The path of least resistance and the fastest route both lead to regression back into the life out of which she's trying to mature. She will always try to go back to what's comfortable for her. That's why she needs you to be able to hold her feet to the fire a little bit with love and tenderness and understanding. But to remind her, that's not reality. That's not who God created you to be. There is more for you. and I'm not going to leave you on that path. Yet the soul that God created in her is very resilient by the power of the Holy Spirit. By his grace, she can begin to develop a freedom of choice in him. She can choose something different than what she's chosen in the past by his grace. She can begin to choose to redirect herself toward him rather than away from him. She will not make these choices alone in most cases. God uses relationships with his children in the here and now to redeem the wounds from relationships of her past. It is amazing to me that God, the wounds that occur in relationship are redeemed in relationship. According to the same methods that helped her survive, God will use what is familiar to sprinkle the essence of Christ our Lord to begin to reveal to her the loss of the true self that she has experienced. It is gradual and slow by our definition, because it is completely paradigm-altering. Doing it too quickly, will frighten and overwhelm her. That's why it's so important that it goes slowly. And it can move her backward in the process. It's a delicate surgery to restore that which is wounded to the fullness for which she was designed. The woman who is willing to see the process through with him until the end, leaving no stone unturned, no page unturned, no thought overlooked, seeing every moment as valuable to her growth and maturity, that woman will gain the wholeness and embrace a thriving relationship with God himself. And that's where we want her to be. So having a basic introduction to the world of a wounded woman, let's give some thought to the truth about who she was created to be versus the reality she perceives for herself because of the trauma she's endured. So what is the truth about women? Let's talk about it for a minute. What do we know? What does Scripture tell us about God's thoughts about women? And you can think back to the Genesis passage about God's creation of Eve. What does God tell us about how he thinks about woman? Created in God's image. What else? She does have a purpose. Pardon me.
Very good.
Very good. What did Adam say when he saw her? Yeah. She's beautiful. God sees woman as beautiful. Wounded women don't see themselves as beautiful. And it's really important that you understand that. Valued. Treasured. God made Eve and he quit creating. She completed creation. That should make you have chills. But a wounded woman can't hear that yet. She can hear it, but she can't hear it in her heart. She can't make application of that truth to her existence as a woman on the earth. She pleases the Creator simply because he made her. So what is the truth for a woman who has been wounded by abuse? The first thing that you need to understand is that her mind and body are completely disconnected from each other. She fragments and compartmentalizes all the areas of her life according to the same methods that helped her survive the trauma of the abuse. Her mind will attempt not to remember. And it doesn't just attempt not to remember the abuse. It shuts out the whole time frame. She may not remember anything about her childhood because as a protective mechanism, the mind will lock away the memories, good, bad, and otherwise, that could possibly lead to the memory of the abuse. Her body will remember. And it will continually attempt to reconnect with her mind. That's why you see some kind of bizarre behaviors from women who have a history of abuse. Because the body is trying to say, pay attention, we need to heal this, this is important, it's something that you need to pay attention to, and the mind is doing everything it can to shut it down. From this compartmentalization, the distractive nature influences inadequate perceptions of herself, from which self-distortions are formed and rooted while being reinforced by negative thinking. That which began as the messages communicated by the abuse she was enduring, either verbal messages or nonverbal messages. They may be things that her abuser said to her, but they may just as well be things that she gleaned for herself from what was happening. Those things become negative self-talk that she reinforces upon herself, even without knowing she's doing it. This is sin, and she doesn't know that it exists in her life. But we must be careful how we point it out to her. You tell a woman who is struggling with wounds of abuse that she's living in sin, and she will walk away from you and she will never come back to talk to you again because she can't see that. And she will feel condemned all over again. We have to be careful about how we walk with her so she discovers her sin for herself, because unless we can discover our sin for ourselves by the power of the Holy Spirit working within us, we're not going to deal with that sin. And she will discover her identity for herself. Doesn't matter how many times you try to reinforce to her what her true identity is, she will not understand it until she figures it out for herself. Let me pause for a moment to say that it is never your job as you walk with a woman, wounded woman, to fix her. It's not your job. And I know men are going, but I don't want to fix it, because that's in your nature to try and fix things. You can't fix it. It's not your job. That's not what the Lord is calling you to do. There is nothing to fix. There is simply a wounded person attempting through the pain of her past to mature into the person that God created her to be. Your job is to walk with her while she makes discoveries about herself, while she questions, while she aches, while she cries, and while she heals. Continually redirect her to God's will for her life, His answers for her questions, and His identity for her. This disconnect of mind and body creates a blindness and a denseness that keeps her from being able to see the reality for what really is and who she really is. She will interpret her world through blindness and denseness, and they often work in tandem with each other through thoughts and experiences. The denseness needs to be worn down and desensitized in order for her own blindness to be exposed so that she can face reality. So having used these words, blindness and denseness, let's talk a little bit about what they mean. Denseness is a mental and physical abnormality that increases internal resistance and greatly limits the truth from occurring naturally. And I'll repeat that so you can get it written down. Denseness is a mental and physical abnormality that increases internal resistance limiting the truth from occurring naturally. A mental and physical abnormality that increases internal resistance, limiting the truth from occurring naturally. She is showing her denseness when she refuses to believe or acknowledge that anything is broken. There's nothing wrong. I'm fine. That's denseness. It's not that she just doesn't want something to be the way that it is. She's not just being difficult. Because of the compartmentalization that is such a natural way of being for her, and because the denseness has not been correctly connected with the body, she is truly unable to see that her perceptions are wrong. She just can't see it. Now, blindness can be used to protect, but it is also the influence of repeating history without insight. Its main root is derived from the depth of the brokenness of self. The more she is unfamiliar with the true self that God created her to be, the more blindness she has in her life. She will reach a point where the denseness is desensitized to the place where she can admit that this isn't working in my life, but she still has no insight to make any changes. In those times, she will experience some blindness to her own functioning. She's willing to change and to do the work that's necessary to heal, but she really has no idea what that means. She doesn't see past her immediate circumstances. Everything about her life is what is happening to me right now, and that's the whole way that she identifies herself. She doesn't see her immortal soul. She can tell you that she does, and she can recite things to make you believe that she gets it. She has the head knowledge, and she can give you the words, but she doesn't have the ability to make application to her own heart and to her own life. She sees her value in performance. She sees herself as a commodity, something to be traded and bid upon. The higher the price that she can earn for herself by presenting the prettiest, the most desirable facade, the more value she has. She's capable of reading many situations and morphing herself into what she thinks people expect of her in each situation. She's a chameleon, and she can perform in whatever setting she's in. Intrinsic value because of her existence as a daughter of the king is something she will convince herself that she lives in, but she has no ability to apply that to her life adequately. Another scenario for you to kind of get a little bit of a glimpse into what the inside of her mind is like. Imagine living in a place where you don't know anything about who you are. You don't know how you got where you are. You're kind of familiar with what's around you. You don't know what qualities make you, you. You don't remember much about the events that formed you. And most difficult and most importantly, you don't know how to answer the question, who am I? Imagine feeling fearful all the time and not knowing why. Imagine having only limited, if any, access to the memories of your past. Imagine being on high alert every moment of every day, even when you're sleeping. Imagine working so hard all the time just to ignore the pain that's going on inside of you. That exhaustion is just a reality that's never going to change. Imagine being resigned to this reality on one hand and desperately hoping that something will change on the other. Do you feel a little anxious? This is the life of a wounded woman. This is reality to an infinite degree. Her levels of anxiety are extremely high because she does not know herself. She is profoundly disconnected from the truth of who God created her to be. She doesn't recognize that anxiety is something that's abnormal because it's something that's been a part of her life for all that she can remember. And she separates herself from it on the surface. You wouldn't be able to tell that she was feeling anxious on the inside because her facade's got it all covered. She can only recognize the dissonance and anxiety in her world to a small degree, if at all. Yet the internal chaos is enough for her to be fearful that someone will ask about her in more than a superficial conversation. She's a master at superficial conversation. She can talk about her job, her kids, her husband, the weather, politics, religion. She can talk about it all. But the moment you sit down face to face and you look her in the eye and you say, how are you? She runs. Or she changes the subject. Or she cries. If you've ever sat with somebody and asked how they were and they started crying and you just kind of went, what the heck was that? There's something unresolved within her that needs to be dealt with. She's not in touch with who God created her to be. You may see and sense a shift in her behavior. You may feel her withdraw or become uneasy. You may sense a change in her that you can't quite put a finger on, but you know that it's there. Internally, she's sorting through an arsenal of tools that she's used throughout her life to determine which one to use to get out of this threatening conversation. She's looking for the part of her that is good at looking good for people, the one that has all the, quote, right answers and can pass a social examination. She's digging for that within herself because she knows that she can do that. The shift may only take a second in your interaction with her. It may happen before you finish your sentence, but it is a very real shift, and the casual conversationist that you've been chatting with is now in performance mode. She's searching your demeanor, your face, your body language, your questions for clues for how you want her to answer. You will not get a sincere answer most of the time, and it's not because she's trying to be deceptive. It's because she doesn't know how. She doesn't have the vocabulary or the experiences to be able to have that kind of conversation with you. She is so out of touch with herself that she can't know what a sincere answer really is. So you have a choice to make. Will you look upon her as someone who refuses to build a sincere relationship and walk away just like everyone else? Because that's what she's thinking if you walk away from her. There's another one. I knew it. Nobody's ever going to have a real relationship with me. Or will you see that there is a disconnectedness, a brokenness that is at work with her, and she needs someone to see the reality of her pain and of her circumstances and not walk away? If you choose to engage a wounded woman, please do so with a commitment to do what is best for her, which oftentimes will require sacrifice from you. Know that you may be in it for many, many years. Know that she may also cut you off at the first sign that you are challenging her facade. It's the only world she knows, and if she feels that it's threatened, she'll push you away. Are you willing to push back, to stay engaged in her life, and to show her that you're a safe person who really does care about her heart? Be committed to honoring her true self, with whom she is completely unfamiliar, which will often bring you into conflict with her facade. Your relationship with her may have times of great celebration as she discovers things, and she'll celebrate some new thing that she's learned about herself, and those are the highest of highs. And for you to get to celebrate with her, for her to allow you into that celebration with her, is a great honor. It may also have times of contention where she challenges you, where she accuses you. Despite your best efforts to love her well. When an accusation comes from a woman that you're trying so hard to love well, it can really knock you back. Don't be surprised by those. They'll come. They'll accuse you of having bad motives in your relationship with them. They'll accuse you of trying to manipulate situations. They'll accuse you of not really loving them. You just want something from me. That's a lie that she's believed from what happened to her. And you have to be willing to walk through that lie until she can see, which may be years down the road, that you really are in it for the long haul and that you really do love her soul, the woman God created her to be, not just this facade that she's put on for everybody to look pretty. Remember that Jesus was willing to lay down his life for those who spat upon him and cursed him. Are you willing to follow the Lord on this path, even though she may do the same thing to you? Maybe not literally, but figuratively she will. If the answer is yes, you need to know some of the realities with which she lives. I want to take a minute to define abuse, because a lot of people think, well, abuse is broken bones, rape, molestation, bruises, those things that are the most visible. But a woman who lives with a man who isolates her, who won't let her have friends, who dictates where she can go, when she can go, how much money she can have, what car she can drive, and takes away her freedom of choice, she's being abused. The woman who, as a child, was told that she'd never be good enough, that her grades were never good enough, that she never looked pretty enough, that she never did this as well as this other child down the street. That child was abused. You can't see the physical wounds of that, but they exist down deep in her soul, just like the wounds of a woman who's been raped or a woman who's been beaten and had broken bones. The wounds are the same. The healing process is very similar, and she must walk through this a very similar thing. So it's really important to understand that abuse is a really broad category. So how do I know so much about this? This is the part that I don't like, so bear with me. I grew up in a home with a father who was a brutal man. The physical abuse of my brother was so extreme that we had body-shaped holes in the walls. It was not unusual. He would chase my brother from room to room, beating him. My brother would break away, run to another room. My dad would chase him down, and my mom was following him the whole time. And then she'd have the nerve to say to us, "Well, you shouldn't have made him mad." Wrap your childhood mind around that. My father began molesting me when I was 4. That continued until I was in junior high. We moved to another city. He was traveling internationally for 3 years, and those were the happiest 3 years of my life. When we moved back to Texas when I was a freshman in high school, and he began to rape me. 2 times during my teenage years, I became pregnant by him. The first time was the week before Christmas, and he loaded me up in the car, and I knew better than to ask questions. It was Christmas time. It was exciting. We were keeping secrets and getting excited about to share things with friends and family. And I thought we were going shopping. I bopped on out to the car, my little teenagerhood, and he didn't say a word. But he drove, and I figured out what he was up to. And he drove me to a clinic. He never said a word to me the entire trip. Walked me into the clinic, and I aborted my first child, 15 years old. I had made a determination before anything happened in that clinic that he was never going to create this kind of pain in my life again, ever. So when I became pregnant again when I was 18... I decided I was going to keep that promise to myself, and he would never hurt me like that, and I would abort this child myself. I finally moved out of the house when I was just a little over 18, moved to college. My husband and I started dating when I was 16. He didn't know. I didn't even really know what was going on in my world because I was shutting it down as soon as it was happening so that I could go out into the world and function. The Lord was very gracious to put that man in my life from a very young age, because who knows where I would have turned had I not had somebody who showed me tenderness and kindness and compassion and was just very good to me. I didn't know how to receive it, but it felt safer than what I was living, so I clung to it, and we've been married now 24 years. Women who have a history of abuse, particularly prolonged, methodical abuse throughout their lives, are difficult to understand. They're difficult to communicate with, and they're difficult to build meaningful relationships with. By God's grace, I've had the right people in my path as I healed. People who were unwilling to let me linger in my brokenness, hiding behind excuses and lies about my real identity. People who were willing to hang in there with me when I was so awkward and I didn't know how to function. And this is not what I've always been like. There have been times, I can't tell you how many times I have cussed my husband up one side and down the other, yet he stuck it out with me. Not because of anything that I did or that I've earned, but because God saw fit to put this faithful man in my life, who's been walking with me through all of my healing. And when I began to deal with the darkness and the reality of my past, really understanding what my past was like, the Lord just really revealed that my husband's commitment and placed the right people at every step of the way. And it's my desire to be that kind of person to other women who may not have the same kind of support system that I have in my home. It's because of the commitment of these people the determined spirit that God created in me before the foundation of the world, and the healing, the grace to heal me in spite of myself, that I can share with you what it is like for a woman wounded by years of abuse trying to navigate the world. The next point is that she lives with a very noisy thought life. The body tries to communicate the reality of its knowledge of the abuse with the mind, which is completely disconnected. The mind attempts either to ignore or make sense out of what she is sensing. The result is that she believes a series of lies about herself. As a child of the King, created in the image of God, she has some understanding of who she is. God's image dwells within her. She knows something about who she's supposed to be. But she's unable to live out of that truth because of all of this chatter about herself that she believes because of what's happened to her. Her continued efforts to distract herself are an attempt not to allow the true self to have appropriate value, except by performance. The value of the true self will continue to be deflected due to the depth of the inadequate self. The noise that exists within her heart and mind is overwhelming. Yet she's unaware of her racing thoughts all the time. It's so normal that she doesn't know that it's there. She covers up this deafening noise with multiple different coping mechanisms. She may stay so busy that she doesn't have time to think. Perhaps she's a young professional and she works 80 hours a week. Well, there's not a whole lot of time to think about life when you're working 80 hours a week. She may completely lose herself in the overscheduled lives of her children. And if her kids are that busy and she's not falling into bed until 11 o'clock at night and she's up again at 5 o'clock the next morning to get ready for her kids' busy schedule the next day, well, she doesn't have a lot of time to think. She may take on the responsibility of the social schedule of her husband's career path. Regardless of how she does it, her busyness is a cover for the overwhelming thought patterns that exist in her mind. Another way she may deal with the noise is by medicating herself, either to slow down the thoughts during the day so she can function, or by knocking herself out at night so that she can actually sleep. There's a place for medications. I am not saying don't ever take medications, because they really can be helpful. I've seen them be hugely beneficial in the lives of many people. Because there are some medications that can slow her thought process so that she can hear the Lord's voice working beneath all the noise. And the goal is always to get her to the point where she's not leaning on the medication. She's now learned to lean on the Lord to discover her true identity. It can be a very helpful tool while she does desensitize the thoughts, with the ultimate goal being a peaceful, quiet thought life through which she discovers more and more of who God created her to be. Now, there can also be some arguments for medications to help her sleep. Women who have this kind of racing thought may look like they're asleep, but their brain is working the whole time they're sleeping, and their sleep is not restful. So you see these women who and they have big bags under their eyes and they're tired all the time. She's like, I don't understand why I'm tired all the time. I'm getting plenty of sleep. Well, her body is sleeping, but her brain is not. If she does sleep, she may be haunted by dreams or nightmares that she's not able to really grasp. As she wakes up, she knows that she's afraid, but she doesn't know what she dreamed about or why. And it's the body trying to reconnect with the mind. Again, this kind of medication should be an aid while the work is going on, with the end goal being an ability to sleep peacefully because the thoughts are resolved through the work of healing. Others may choose to deal with the noise by completely checking out of life, by overeating or starving themselves, by pursuing extreme levels of physical fitness. I've seen all of those, by the way. Extremes of any kind in life are unhealthy and can be an indication that for whatever reason, peace and a quiet thought life are not part of that person's normal way of functioning. Whoops. She feels alone. Despite people being around her and doing everything they can to help her, feeling alone is a safety mechanism that avoids unresolved hurts from surfacing. While reinforcing the negative feelings of inadequacy. Despite how desperately lonely she may feel, she will not let anybody inside of her bubble. She doesn't even let herself inside of it. She has spent much of her life in an attempt to create a facade that helps her be able to function in the world. In reality, this facade exists as an overprotection of the loss of the true self. Others around her will see that it doesn't work for her, and they will try to tell her that they see her life not working for her. But she is unable to see how inefficiently she's functioning in the world. This is the only way that she knows how to be, and her world will be rocked as she begins to realize that her facade is ineffective and needs to be redefined in her life. It doesn't necessarily mean that she's not willing to do the work or that she doesn't want to. Even a woman who wants to do the work, who is willing to dive into the deepest recesses of her soul with the Lord to try and recover the true self that she was created to be, will have her world rocked. She will think of everything in the world through the filters she created to survive her abuse. These filters are in place as a protective mechanism, and much like I told you that I could put aside what happened to me the moment it was over so that I could go function in the world, I had coping mechanisms to be able to do that. Problem is, I saw the whole world through those coping mechanisms. God is gracious to allow us a measure of protection that allows us to continue to function in the depths of unbearable pain. Yet as we mature in Him after the abuse has ended, we must learn to put aside those filters so that we can see the world through His eyes, so that we can accept the reality of His truth as it's being worked out in our lives. One thing to understand about the impact of abuse is that it is not limited in her life. It impacts every area of her life. She does not know or understand that she sees life through these filters. Every relationship she has, every choice that she makes, every way she chooses to function in the world is tainted by those filters that are in place because of the wounds of her past. The people she chooses to hang around, the person she chooses to date or marry, the choices she makes about career, children, family, social circles, or education, her choices about food, fitness, sleep, health. Every choice she makes is tainted by the abuse, yet still under the control of a sovereign and loving God who will pursue her and will heal her when His time is right. She will often live in a world created by the dissociation she employed to survive the trauma while it was occurring. What is dissociation? Dissociation happens in all people to varying degrees and for various reasons. You've all had these moments where you're driving somewhere and all of a sudden you arrive and you think, how should I get here? I don't even remember driving here. That's dissociation on a very small scale. The brain checks out and the body takes over functioning. In extreme cases of abuse, dissociation is a compartmentalization of the trauma. The memories, the sensations, the emotions, and the experiences are all tucked away in a tidy little compartment where they are kept, quote, safe, until the time is right for them to be adequately acknowledged, desensitized, and healed. For some women, this dissociation is so profound that memories of any kind from the times of the abuse are absent. I will never forget the day that I lost my job because I was teaching high schoolers, and in my woundedness, I was behaving just like them. And quite honestly, I needed to lose that job. I needed not to be influencing these young people with my own foolishness in my brokenness. And our senior pastor was the superintendent of the small Christian school where I was working, and they decided not to renew my contract. And they broke the news to me and then encouraged me to pursue counseling with my pastor. Of course, I was angry. How could they do this to me? I've been working there for so long, and it was just a complete violation of everything that I thought I had earned. My performance was being threatened, and I didn't know what to do with it. So my husband was kind of baffled by the whole situation and went with me to our senior pastor's office. And he asked my husband, Stephen, share with me your fondest childhood memory. I freaked because I thought, he's going to ask me that question too. I don't have one. I could remember nothing of my childhood, nothing. And I had remembered for the couple of years leading up to this thinking, this is weird. Why don't I remember anything before I got out of high school? Why don't I have any memories? And this is where that superficiality comes in. I was great, as long as you want to talk about stuff up here. But as soon as you asked me to talk about my past that I couldn't remember, panic set in. When she works so hard to lock away the bad memories, the good ones get locked away with them. This is a protection that allows her to continue to function, though without any sense of herself or her reality. For others, the memories are made available to her consciously, but the emotions are completely detached from the memories. She can talk to you all day long about everything that ever happened, and you're going, oh my gosh, how can she not cry about this stuff? This is horrible. It's because she's completely detached from her emotions. In these cases, the impact, emotion, and memories must be reunited. And this sounds horrible to say, and it was one of the things that I used to hate about my therapeutic process, was I had to go back into that memory. Well, don't you know, I locked that away for a reason, because it was painful in the first place, and I do not want to go back into it again. When I finally stopped fighting and said, okay, Lord, I'll do what you're asking, but I'm not going to be happy about it, I finally started to understand. Because that emotion that I should have felt in that moment, the fear, the rage, the hatred of my father, the just utter confusion about what is going on here, this is not right, was all tucked away. But when I could start to face it and reattach it to who I am today, then it could start having less and less impact on me. Are there any questions to this point? I certainly don't want to lock you guys out of the question, if you have any. I know some of this can be really hard to swallow, so chew on it, and we'll talk again at the end. The extent to which a woman dissociates from the reality of her past is a direct correlation to the depth of the brokenness of her true self. If she can't remember thing one about her childhood, she has no sense of her true self. The brokenness goes to the core of who she is, and it's going to take her a really long time to work through it. I've been in therapy for 12 years. I worked through the trauma in about the first 5 years. And over the last 7 years, I've been redefining my world according to who God says I am, which is the hardest part of the process, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. The healing of a woman who struggles with dissociation is very long and quite profound because the denseness and blindness are so intense. It takes the smallest baby steps for her to begin to allow the reunification of her thoughts. I mean, think about that. Something you haven't thought about in decades, maybe, surfaces and you know it's true. And it can be just the smallest little thing, but it can take you hours of time in working with a counselor to just desensitize it enough that you can talk about it without crying. And that's just one little thing, and you've got this big old mountain that you're trying to chip away at. The slightest reemergence of the pain of the abuse is enough to send her reeling through many weeks of work. The most valuable thing a mentor can do for a woman struggling to reunify her thoughts and emotions is to be kind, be sensitive, be firm, and be loving. She is not allowed to say, I can't, I won't, or I don't know. Because the reality is she can, she will by God's grace, and she does know, she's just not connected with it yet. So it's okay to let that be the answer in the moment, but we always come back to it. When I lead a Bible study, I always tell my ladies, you can cuss me up one side and down the other. I don't care what language you use in here because this is the place to do it. What you've been through is awful, and that language describes appropriately what you've been through. Do not say to me, I'm sorry, if you cry, because if you don't cry, I'm going to kick you to make you. It's never okay to say, I'm sorry for crying, because that's what she needs to do, and she needs to know that that is the way you stand with her. She cannot say, I can't, she cannot say, I won't, and she cannot say, I don't know. That's usually when they start throwing things at me. But it's worth it. So worth it. Expect no explanations, because she can't give them to you. She only knows that I feel overwhelmed right now and all I know how to do is cry. That's okay. That is enough of an explanation until the Lord reveals enough that she can give you an explanation. And then she doesn't owe you an explanation. Her decision to talk about her reality has to be hers. She can't feel like you expect her to explain her past to you. Let her pain be real and just be there to help her through it the best way that you can. Remember, there's nothing to fix. She simply must mature past the disconnection with her true self. She spends most of her time defining herself by her circumstances and by the behaviors of others around her. Because she's unable to connect with herself internally, she's only able to see herself in the immediate circumstances, in the way that others treat her and in the way she responds to people. She will find fault in her own behaviors for the behaviors of others. Well, if so-and-so hadn't done that to me, I wouldn't behave that way. I wouldn't have done that if it wasn't for that person. Which, bunk. But that's all she knows. She will see herself as innocent because someone else's actions in her mind justified her response. She sees herself as incapable of responding out of her identity as one of God's children because she doesn't see that that applies to her. So how do you respond when you see this in her life? Continually point her back to her identity, to her ability to make choices about her responses, and put the responsibility for her choices back on her rather than on others. We have a lot of women that will come through our ministry who will talk about their relationship, particularly with their husbands if they're married. Well, our marriage is just such a mess because he. No, stop. What about you? I'm not interested in what he's doing. I'm interested in what you're contributing to this marriage. But he, no. Where are you? Let's talk about you. She can't do it at first. It takes her a long time to be able to do it. But you have to continually point her back to that. This can go on for years, and it often takes conflict and challenge before she will be able to respond any differently. You may get into some really heated arguments with her because she will insist that her behavior is a response to somebody else, and it's not her fault. Often she will have to fall hard before she's able to take personal responsibility for her choices and choose anything different for herself. And that's the hardest thing. When you love somebody and you're walking with them and you're watching them walk into something that you know is just going to be a disaster, what do? You let them walk. And when they fall and they come back to you and say, I don't know what happened. Yeah, I know. Let's get up, dust yourself off. Let's try this again and let's ask the Lord to reveal more of what he wants you to do in a certain situation. While she must work through the impact of the trauma in order to find the path of healing, that's not the most important value. In order to fully mature into the woman that God created her to be, she must redefine herself in every area of her life by the truth that God is revealing to her. This is the most difficult part of the healing process. The healing of the impact of the trauma decreases and desensitizes the denseness that she's lived with, allowing for a consideration that maybe there's another way to function in the world. The redefinition of herself is peeling back the layers of blindness that have kept her from seeing reality throughout her life. Confronting the blindness and recovering the sight God created her to experience is by far the most difficult part of the process. Oh, I got ahead of myself. Okay. A couple of things to summarize. The role of a mentor is to broaden her perspective and teach the value of allowing unresolved emotions naturally. Allowing her to cry purposefully as she grieves the loss of self she suffered, and not expecting her to have answers that make you more comfortable. You want answers because it makes you more comfortable, not because it helps her. That's where we have to make that shift into I'm willing to be uncomfortable if it's what's best for her. That's one of the most important things you can do for her. There is a denseness in trauma that regularly impedes one's ability to comprehend easily. She can hear and she can memorize. She may have a knowledge of the Bible that puts you and me to shame, but she cannot apply it to herself. One of the dearest women that I've worked with is this way. And she loves other people and she cares so kindly for other people, but when you ask her to make application to her own life, she can't do it. And then she gets mad that you challenged her about it. Yet I still challenge her about it. Because it's what's best for her. It's what she needs. Her marriage won't heal. Her children won't mature. She won't grow with the Lord if she's not able to learn to do these things. Individual or small group discipleship is critical, along with her gradually emerging to be able to hear in general. Additionally, a small group or individual environment allows for her to hear one or two voices at a time and not be swayed by a multitude of voices. Because if she's in a Bible study with 8 or 10 other ladies, and you have one that's vocal and maybe not quite accurate all the time, and she hears something that tickles her ear, that's where she's going. And you don't want her going there. You want her staying right here with you because you're teaching her the truth about who she is. She will lean into a mentor, hoping for directions for how to pace the layers of overwhelming darkness that need the insight of the true impact of the trauma. In the redefinition of self, if there is not some internal freedom occurring, then you got to go deeper. If she's not able to start seeing herself for herself, you're not deep enough yet. Go deeper. Ask her more challenging questions. Meddle. Get in her business. Ask her and challenge her beyond what she's willing to do on the surface. That's where we grow, is when people get up in our business. The true redefining of self is as threatening as the original trauma. Yet allowing the vulnerable true self to choose for the first time since the trauma is critical for her ongoing healing without the use of defense mechanisms, which continue to put barriers between this facade and the true self. We talk a lot about defense mechanisms in our Bible study just to help the ladies understand that they don't have to use them. They don't have to deflect everything onto somebody else. They don't have to make their behavior somebody else's fault. They don't have to choose to make excuses for everything that they do and for everything that they've been through. And there are dozens of different defense mechanisms that we talk about through the time that we're together in our Bible study. And then we show them the one who did it perfectly. Jesus suffered unbearably from the time he was born until the time he left the earth. There is nothing that any one of us who's ever walked the earth before or since has ever experienced that Jesus didn't. He never put up a single defense mechanism, ever. Every time he endured another struggle, another trauma, and believe me, he endured trauma, he trusted God with it. And he submitted his will to the Father. And because he did, we can learn to. That's what we're called to do, to become more like him. The vocabulary you use with her is being interpreted in a way that is likely different from what you mean. Core words are unfamiliar to her, or she's translating them differently from what you are using them to mean. And she needs to experience these things kind of like a kindergartner learning to read. She's starting over. She's learning, it's like learning a second language as an adult. You start back with the three-letter words and start making application of what this word means. And it's a very, it's an evolution of language that she's learning. And she has to go back to the very beginning, rebuilding each step as she goes. There are some things that she's going to say to you as you go through this process. I'm so tired. Usually, she says that as an excuse not to take the next step, but it is painfully true. She is tired. Just don't accept it as the final word. I'm confused. She certainly is, because nothing makes sense in her mind. I feel so alone. Nobody understands. All I'm good for is fill in the blank. I'll never be good enough. These are all things that she says to herself time and time and time again, and she believes every one of them because she's functioning out of her brokenness, not out of her true identity as a daughter of the King. When she says things to you that seem to be hyperbole, don't overreact with frustration toward her, because she'll get really melodramatic in a real quick hurry. Remind her of the obstacle that she overcame last week. Remember when you said this to me last week, and look what the Lord's done. Let's keep walking through this together. You can do this. Remind her of the growth of the relationship that she's been working on. That relationship with her husband that is finally starting to show some maturity, because she's taking steps that she's beginning to see more of what God designed in their marriage. And the two of them are working together to come toward that ideal. Remind her of who she is as a daughter of the King, and encourage her to lean into him when her reality seems more real than his truth. Trauma's like a fable. It always teaches a lesson, if we are willing to learn. You will often find wounded women in a position that resembles a quote by Winston Churchill: I'm always ready to learn, although I do not always like to be taught. The reason she struggles to be taught, despite the reality that she desires to learn, is that she must change the way she operates. And that's hard for everybody. She must learn to cry correctly, not reactively. Most of the time, when people cry, it's in response to a circumstance. Something has happened that has caused me to feel this way, and so I cry. When you walk with a wounded woman, the goal is to help her focus on, this is what I'm feeling, this is the reality that is grieving my heart, I'm going to cry about that on purpose for a defined period of time. Because think about being in a room filled with water. If you can let just a little bit of it out, then there's finally space to breathe. And then the next time you come back to that, then she can cry a little bit more, and then there's more room to breathe. And as the water in the room starts to get down to your ankles, well, you can function more normally. And it's the same way with her. As she deals with these things, she can function more normally each time she takes a step to cry on purpose, with a purpose, trying to desensitize the impact of what she's been through. She must learn to make an emotional adjustment before she tries to understand what's going on. If all she's trying to do is figure it out, her body's not going to reveal what it needs. She's not going to connect. Mind and body won't connect. There's too much emotion in the way. However, if she will allow the emotional adjustment, that crying on purpose, if she will allow that to happen, insight will occur naturally. The mind and body will make a connection, and she'll go, oh my goodness, that's where that comes from. I never knew why I responded to that, but that makes sense. And then she can start to redefine why she functions the way she does and make different choices. Otherwise, she ends up taking a step backward. And I can't tell you how many times I fought with my counselor. I do not want to cry today. I want to talk. Okay, well, let's talk about X. I don't want to talk about that. She'll put up barriers. She'll try to make excuses for why not to cry, because crying hurts. But it is the best thing that she can do for her own healing. She does not have the ability to be comfortable in her own skin, to expect anything different from her. She can't do it. Yet being comfortable in her own skin is the way that the body can become more mature and more profound, rather than solving problems in the moment by performing. If I'm forced to be uncomfortable in my own skin, rather than put on a facade, then my true self has to mature. If I put on the facade, then we go back to status quo and I haven't grown. But if I will put away the facade long enough to be uncomfortable for a moment, that moment is wonderful for my growth. Clearly, this presentation is not enough for me to tell you everything that there is to know about working with wounded women. This is what the Lord has called me to do, as well as the people who work with me. We've been working with wounded women across the past 6 years, and this ministry was born from a seed that God planted in my heart over 10 years ago. And he's been pruning me and teaching me since then to teach others what he has taught me. There is a need for this information in your churches. There are wounded women in every church. There's not one, not one church on the face of the planet that doesn't have at least one wounded person in it. They either sit silently in the pews week after week, never reaching out for the help that they desperately need, or they create drama and upheaval because they don't know how to be okay in their own brokenness. You guys know what I'm talking about. I see the smiles. It happens. Either way, the church as a whole lacks the education and the desire to help these women. And I think it's less about desire than it is about education. When somebody shares a story like mine, I mean, I can read faces. It's hard. You don't want to hear that. I don't know what to do with that, so I'm going to step away. Nobody can blame you for that, but I can blame you for that. Don't do that. Be educated. Learn how to come alongside people like me, because if it wasn't for people who did come alongside me, I wouldn't be here to help the women that God is bringing after me. It is our greatest desire to educate people in churches, both pastors and elders and deacons, as well as lay leaders and women in your church who just have a heart to be kind to other hurting people. We want to help you to see, to understand, and to be equipped to help bring healing into the lives of these women. As they begin to taste the grace and beauty of God dwelling fully in their lives, they can become great servants in their communities and in their congregations. One of the things that has been so amazing about some of the women we've worked with is we've seen troublemakers become really faithful servants because their woundedness is being dealt with. They become agents of transformation in others. And that is a beautiful thing to witness. There are options available to your churches to gain greater understanding and more in-depth training to be able to impact the women in your communities who have a history of trauma in their lives. You are welcome to stop by our table. We have a table down in the fellowship hall. We've also given each of you one copy of all of our materials. You have a brochure that outlines the programs that we offer. You have a statement of beliefs that is right in line with PCA's statement of beliefs. And you have business cards. If you want to take more of these back to your church and share with the people that are in your congregations, please do. Take as many as you need. We have plenty. Take a handful of them and share them with people that you know. Before we're done, are we doing okay with time? Okay. Questions? Yes, ma'am.
When you're having the Bible studies, are these individual studies or are they group studies?
We do them in small groups. We have had groups from anywhere from two participants, to we always cap it at 10. We don't ever want more than 10 because it allows people to hide or for one person to dominate, and so we keep them small so that nobody has the opportunity to slip away. Yes, ma'am.
So when they come, you already know that they've been abused?
Yes, and we do an intake form with them where they share as much as they will until we've built a relationship. Often we don't get the whole story, but they'll tell us one nugget. So we know that there's a history, and usually when there's one nugget, there's usually something else. Because abuse leads to abuse, leads to abuse. She learns not to expect much of herself or of anybody else in relationship to her, and it leads to more abusive relationships in her life. So yes, we do always know when a woman comes to us that she has a history of abuse. And, you know, I'm one person, and Sarah is my co-leader, and she and I, we have an administrative person who helps with all of this, all of the printed stuff, and takes care of all the background stuff for us. But even with the wonderful group that I have working with me, we're only us. There's three of us. And I can't be effective in your churches because I don't have relationships with those ladies. I can come and teach an 11-week Bible study in your church, but it's not going to help them be effective ministers and servants in your congregation. They're going to benefit from somebody within their church leading them in a Bible study and building an ongoing relationship so that they can continue to walk in their healing. That's why it's our greatest desire to take what the Lord has given to us, clone us, if you will, and put other branches, if you will, of us in different churches around the country and see what the Lord does with it. That's our heart's desire, so we're waiting for him to open the doors.
Just a comment about women that come to us. We've had a number of them who actually have come in the first meeting. They'll say, kind of go around the introduction, I don't know why I'm here. I'm not sure I fit. Mm-hmm. You know, well, we know that they fit because they wouldn't have shown up. But, you know, they're questioning, am I qualified? This happened. Mm-hmm. Only that happened. And, of course, we just say, keep coming. You know, keep coming back. And those have been some of the most profound aha moments mm-hmm. in their lives when they get in touch with the fact that of their own brokenness and that truly hope is found in Christ Jesus and what that might may mean. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you talk with women and they kind of indicate things, it's just always good to just say, come along. Mm-hmm. You know, just come along. Take a look.
And quite honestly, everything that we do really is applicable to every believer. All of us need this kind of self-reflection. We're all impacted by sin.
So, since you can't go all over propagating this, do you give like a outline or a sample study for others to use within their churches?
Mm-hmm. What we do is we always require a church that is interested in having a study in their congregation. We require a core group of people, 4, 5, 6 people minimum, that want to be trained in what we're doing, because we have got to have a prayer foundation behind us. There's got to be a group of people in that congregation that know the battles that we're fighting with these ladies. And the culture of the church needs to be influenced to understand these ladies. And that comes when it's not just the two of us leading a study, but our whole session has been trained to understand what it is we're doing. So we always require a small group of, whether it's leadership or lay people, it doesn't matter to us, but people who are important to the congregation, that the congregation will talk to them and that they have an influence. And then we train teams of a minimum of 2 ladies. We always ask that they teach in pairs because you never know when something's going to go off the rails and you need to remove somebody from a class because they've had an emotional breakdown and it's just too much to freak out the other ladies with. So we always make sure that there are 2 people that are trained, and we do a long weekend, a 4-day training where you are immersed in the materials that we use. We do a lot of role-playing. What happens if you encounter this type of situation? And we walk you through pretty much everything that we've seen in the years that we've seen a lot. you know, how do you handle somebody who has a psychological break right in the middle of a Bible study? You know, how do you go about interviewing a counselor so that you have a resource to give to a lady who needs something more than what you can give? So we want to train teams of 2 or more women who want to lead, and we want to have a core group of people in that congregation who are fully on board, supporting and trained, so that they know what's going on in the ministry as it moves forward. Yes, ma'am.
Is that 4 days, the hunger and humility and the hands and feet of Christ, or are those separate?
Those are separate. But we can do the hands and feet of Christ is a 3-hour seminar, so it can be combined into that 4 days.
And then what's the 2.5 days down here?
two half-day, thank you.
Oh, you know what? That's another one of our old brochures. We printed them, and we have a lot left, and we paid for them, so we're using them. That one is, the first one is just an opportunity to come and just talk to your pastors. Just say, here we are, this is what we do, here's the information. The second one, the one that says two half days, we had been doing that across two half days. Participation is really hard for the guys in the church to get for two half days, so we have condensed that down into 1 3-hour session.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then in answer to what you receive to be able to do the Bible study, we have a printed 11-week Bible study that would be the curriculum that you use to lead the Bible study. And it's really, it's the gospel. Mm-hmm. It does deal with specifics and some of what Betty's just taught here, a broad overview. We go into specifics with the first half of it. It's more or less, let's look at what happened. And the last half of it is, let's look at what God's doing, reading in the Bible. And so it really takes a focus. We also have a week in there that the loved ones, they can invite someone to come. That might be a husband, a spouse, a friend, a mother, you know, we've just a best friend. And they come, and actually Betty's husband is so gracious. He comes and he speaks from the point of being a loved one walking alongside and shares. And they kind of, Betty will talk to the spouses. Or
we tag team them.
Yeah, and then Stephen would talk to the ladies. And then trade and answer questions and everything to give them a good idea. And then we kind of shift our focus, and the study begins to look at more of what is God doing in your life, and that transforming grace, the gospel transformation that takes place in the healing. So it really is broad. And 11 weeks might sound long to you, or it may sound short to you, but it is enough to get them well on the road to healing. And many do have those, as I call them, those aha moments, really where there's a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're realizing true hope is in Christ Jesus. And to see themselves differently.
Okay, go ahead.
I know you said you went through counseling. Mm-hmm. Do those who teach this course need to have credentials in counseling, or just one another?
They have to have a willing heart, an ability to learn, and just a desire to walk with these ladies, and a willingness to say, whoop, I don't know how to handle that, I need help. And we do require, when they are given the ability to use our materials and to lead a study, they are required during the time that a study is going on to be involved in conference calls with me. Because I want them to continue tapping into resources. I don't want them doing this on their own. It's too hard. I had a great resource that has helped me, my counselor. I still talk to him all the time because he's helping me do all of this. And they can't do it by themselves, so they always have to continue while their studies are going on. They can troubleshoot and ask questions about, why I saw this, what do I do about this? And so you don't have to have a credential. I'm not a licensed counselor. I am a certified biblical counselor. This is where God's put me, and there's no credential that I can put behind my name that's going to alter what the Lord's given me to share.
And did do both secular counseling and Christian counseling in my own life. And the Lord has continued to use that. So I have a heart for women and for the ministry. But one of the things that's been most valuable, of course, is the Word of God. Because every answer to life's difficult questions is found there. And then having some specific knowledge of how to deal with us and help us, you know, also makes a difference. But one of the key things is having that foundation in your church, being able to walk in and say, okay, I know the session's going to meet on Tuesday night or whatever, and submit some prayers, you know, not specifically for specific women, but for you as a leader, because it is difficult. It's hard work.
It's hard.
It really is. And Betty and I committed that the day after we typically lead a class,
we don't work that day.
We kind of don't have anything that's too taxing on our brains. Because sometimes you can be a bit like jello, and because you don't know what you're going to encounter, but it's rewarding work. Mm-hmm. And to see women kind of come to a place where they begin to trust in the one true God. Mm-hmm.
There's one question in the back here.
I was going to go back to a little of your story. Mm-hmm. You said you got fired,
mm-hmm.
and your church, I guess, saw something that you needed help
mm-hmm.
and encouraged.
My best friend got me fired, little stinker.
And they encouraged you to get counseling. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you were causing drama.
Mm-hmm.
In the, and did you initially know you needed counseling when they said that?
I was in that dense place where I'm like, there is nothing wrong with me. I am fine. I'm only crying because my husband travels every other week and my life is just really hard. I have two little children at home. And so I was making all the excuses for why things are hard for me right now, but this is just the phase of life that I'm in, and clearly it went deeper than that.
Did you share with your husband your background?
No, because like remember that I told you that I was tucking everything away? I had no memory.
So at that point, you were married what?
We were married 12 years at that point. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he still didn't know.
No, oh, he knew something was wrong.
Yeah,
he knew something was wrong. He'd just kind of look at me and go, I don't know what's going on with you, but this is a little weird. Yeah, he knew something was wrong, and he kind of had an inkling. But, you know, he knew my parents. We dated in high school, so he knew my family. And he always knew something was a little bit off, but he was 18 at the time. 18-year-old kids don't have that kind of insight. There's no way he could have done anything differently. So.
Was your best friend, though?
I didn't have a best friend.
The one that told him.
No, the one that got me fired. No, she didn't know specifically, but she knew something was wrong. She was seeing all the signs, and she's like, there's abuse there. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the story is, but something's not right. And boy, did she find out.
And at that point, had you believed on Christ?
Yes, I was a believer at that point, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Lord was very gracious in bringing me to himself and then showing me my brokenness first, because I don't know that I would have come to him if it had been the other way around. Of course, he's sovereign, and he will do what he will do. But I'm thankful that he did it the way he did. Yeah. Another question here.
Do you tend to see more differences or more similarities in women that suffer childhood abuse versus abuse through crime or spousal abuse? Are there more similarities or more differences?
I'm not sure if I would call them similarities or differences. There are a lot of, the wounds are the same. The manifestation of the wounds is very different. When you're dealing with somebody who has childhood abuse issues, their immaturity, it just shows. We behave like children because our growth stunted at the point that abuse was part of life. So a woman who is already mature, who endures a violent rape, she's going to have the same kind of brokenness, but she's already got some maturity, so her manifestation of the wounds is going to be different than somebody like me who has a history of childhood abuse.
They both may suffer and would most likely suffer post-traumatic stress syndrome, so you're going to see some commonalities there, but some of the impact in the way it plays out and what it looks like is going to be somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
And just for the reason that Betty was talking about, the impact is much the same, but it really does can look a little bit different.
I am free for the next couple of hours. Come talk to me. I don't want to keep you here any longer. Go eat some dinner. But thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you today.